Have you ever felt guilty walking past a homeless person, then justified it by thinking about the bills you need to pay? Now, imagine someone who never makes that justification, who reorganizes their entire life around the suffering of strangers. These people exist. They adopt 20 children. They donate half their income to strangers overseas. They dedicate their careers to chickens and factory farms. They make us profoundly uncomfortable. And that discomfort reveals something crucial about how we all navigate morality. These aren't your typical volunteers or occasional charity donors. These are people who've taken moral logic to its extreme conclusion and refuse to look away. They live with an overwhelming sense of duty that reshapes every decision, what they eat, where they live, whether to have children. The term do-gooder itself carries a sting of judgment, suggesting meddling or self-righteousness. Benjamin Franklin abandoned his quest for moral perfection partly because he worried it would make him ridiculous or envied and hated. Our discomfort isn't just defensive guilt. It's genuine uncertainty about whether such a life is admirable or alien, whether it represents human excellence or a troubling absence of ordinary pleasures and loves. What separates these individuals from the rest of us? They live as if it's always wartime. During actual wars, extreme selflessness becomes normal. People leave families for causes, sacrifice for strangers, expand their duty beyond comfortable boundaries. When war ends, we return to peacetime morality, caring primarily for those close to us. But for do-gooders, the war never ends. 800 million people live in extreme poverty. Billions of animals suffer in factory farms. Children die from preventable diseases. The do-goer experiences distant suffering with the same urgency most reserved for a drowning child directly in front of them. This creates inevitable tension between family and strangers. Most people consider caring for family the heart of morality, but do-gooders question this assumption. They love their families, but don't believe they inherently deserve better treatment than anyone else's. Religious traditions offer different solutions. Muslims leave 2/3 of their estate to family. Jews give 10 to 20% to charity. Gandhi believed pursuing goodness required forswearing exclusive loves, which Orwell found both repellent and admirable. The question remains unresolved. Should we care for strangers at our family's expense? Dorothy Granada, approaching 80, trained midwives in remote Nicaraguan mountain settlements, teaching traditional birth attendants to recognize dangerous pregnancies, monitor blood pressure, and handle domestic violence cases. Her transformation began when she met Charles Gray, who'd calculated the world equity budget, approximately $1,200 per year, his estimate of a fair share of global wealth. Dorothy immediately adopted this lifestyle, quitting her job, selling her house, learning to dumpster dive. Unlike Charles's puritanical approach, she insisted on small pleasures like wine and coffee, seeing their poverty as simple justice. In Muluku, a dangerous frontier settlement during Nicaragua's Civil War, Dorothy established a women's health clinic with a local cooperative. Despite bathing in creeks and navigating impassable roads, they built a clinic providing birth control, prenatal care, and refuge from violent husbands. Dorothy treated everyone, including Contra fighters, believing healthcare could enable reconciliation, a principle that saved her life when a former Contra patient prevented an attack on the clinic. After nearly 20 years, she discovered the cooperative had transformed it into a fee-charging private clinic, betraying everything she'd worked for. Aaron Pitkin devoted his life to improving chicken welfare based on utilitarian math. With over 8 billion chickens killed yearly in America, he could alleviate more suffering through this cause than any other. He focused on factory farms, where chickens endure chronic pain in their brief 6-week lives. Aaron's extreme frugality strained relationships. He reduced spending to $9,000 annually, while his girlfriend Jen felt guilty about small purchases. When she asked him to pay off her credit card debt using his trust fund, he refused, arguing the money was needed by starving people and animals in cages. He viewed his inheritance as blood money, redeemable only through alleviating extreme suffering. After separating from Jen, Aaron obsessed over efficiency. He created productivity flowcharts, positioned his computer beside his bed, experimented with minimal sleep, and worked while walking on a treadmill. He avoided socializing, valuing guaranteed work output over uncertain friendship benefits. Yet his work achieved victories. Major companies committed to humanely raised poultry, California mandated more space for egg-laying hens, and American meat consumption began declining. With professional success and a new relationship with Leona, who shared his ethical principles, Aaron found himself unexpectedly happy. Julia Wise had always felt morally obligated to value strangers equally to herself, a conviction that seemed obvious to her but strange to everyone else. As a social worker, she realized her greatest impact came through donating most of her income to effective charities. When her fiancé Jeff bought her a candy apple after college, she broke down crying that night, realizing the money could have bought life-saving bed nets. Jeff also cried, wondering how they could build a life together with Julia seeing malarial children everywhere. They created a financial system. Jeff would give 50% of his income, while Julia gave 100% of hers, with strict personal allowances that couldn't be donated. They meticulously tracked every purchase in spreadsheets. Their giving fluctuated with circumstances. $28,309 in 2009, nothing in 2011 while Julia attended school, $127,556 by 2014. Julia's greatest moral challenge came with motherhood. Having children in a first world country was environmentally damaging, and the resources required could save many lives elsewhere. She decided to have a baby, partly comforted by Jeff's calculation that if their child donated 10% of its income, they would break even. Unlike Peter Singer, who spent heavily on his mother's Alzheimer's care, Julia maintained she would choose cost-effective interventions over her own family if more families could be spared suffering. Sue and Hector Badeau adopted 20 children alongside their two biological children, taking in those unlikely to find homes due to age, disability, or trauma. Hector, from a family of 16 with an abusive father, vowed by age 12 to become a different kind of parent. After adopting Jose, Raj, cerebral palsy, and Joelle, fetal alcohol syndrome, they met four siblings at a conference who felt instantly like family. Sue created elaborate systems, color-coded chore charts, prayer schedules, a comprehensive family handbook. They continued adopting six teenage abuse survivors, then children with severe disabilities, including Alicia, cerebral palsy, Dylan, blind with brain damage, and Wayne, terminal Sanfilippo syndrome. Devastating crises emerged. Teenagers had unplanned pregnancies. Fisher descended into crime and imprisonment. Then, the ultimate crisis. Abel had a sexual relationship with his 16-year-old sister, Alicia. The family fractured. Sue fell into profound depression, questioning her entire mission. She slowly recovered by accepting her limited role, a small creature laying bricks in what might someday be a cathedral. Most children still gathered for holidays, testament they remained a family. Do-gooders challenge our comfortable assumptions about what we owe to others. Philosopher Peter Singer's shallow pond argument cuts to the core. If you'd wade in to save a drowning child, despite ruining expensive shoes, why is spending money on luxuries acceptable when that same amount could save a child's life overseas? Most people distinguish between rescue, a duty, and charity, optional, but Singer argues that physical and emotional distance carry no moral weight. Fiction rarely celebrates do-gooders, often portraying virtuous characters as personally repellent, ineffective, or ridiculous, like Don Quixote. Fiction prizes the complex and particular over the ideal, encouraging us to love humans as they are rather than as they should be. Yet, without these strange, hopeful, tough, idealistic, demanding people, our world would be worse. They remind us that goodness isn't about feeling good, it's about doing good, even when difficult, even when no one is watching. Their lives stand as both inspiration and rebuke, showing what's possible while highlighting how far most of us fall short.